WNST, Towson Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We're positively into the post-Preakness parade, and we have a real pennant race going on around here. I got a baseball fan coming on. He will understand the differences between the summer in Baltimore. We're going to be doing the Maryland Crab Cake Tour, and he's exactly the kind of guest we're going to have out here all summer long. The governor's coming out. The mayor's coming out. Everybody's coming out. It's all brought to you by the Maryland Lottery and our friends at Window Nation, 866-90-NATION. Go find them. I have a real writer on, and I aspire one day to have my Wikipedia say, American writer. Will Leach joins us now. Long time reader of yours. You know this. He makes his home in Athens, Georgia, but he still roots for Illinois and the St. Louis Cardinals and running around with family and Springsteen concerts and all sorts of things and places we've been. He has inked yet another new book, and I'm going to let him tell you all about it, because you do so. You never cease to amaze me with your writing, because I'm sort of a journalism guy, right? Like, I can write books, I can write first person, but I can't make stuff. I'm not a fiction person. I don't read it. I don't write it. And I'm always drawn to when folks like you that are so good at what you do, at your craft, just say, nah, it's like, I play the guitar, I'm going to go play the bass for a while. I feel like that's what your kind of writing is when you come to me with something. It's Will Leach. He ain't doing sports no more, you know, like that, right?
I'm still writing sports. Don't worry. I'll always be writing sports. But you know, it's fun. I love writing journalism, whether it's sports or politics or entertainment or all the things I write about. But, you know, at a certain level, I write a novel basically every couple of years. And one nice thing about writing a novel, when you're writing journalism, you have to stick. It's very annoying. You have to stick to the things that actually happened. It's very frustrating. I love to be able to write a novel and just make the people do what I want them to.
Anybody in my life would tell you I have a hell of a sense of imagination. You know, so like, I guess I have the ingredients. I guess as a kid, I never really sat down, maybe book reporting, but I was so, I read newspapers every day of my life, and I read Sports Illustrated. Like, that's how I knew how to write. That's how I learned how to write. I didn't get lost in Hardy Boys books, as an example, beyond Curious George, right? But like, were you that kind of writer, or were you always aspiring to be the Deadspin guy that sort of you became to me when I got to know you?
I certainly loved writing. It's funny. I loved writing and I loved sports. And it took me a while to realize, oh, wait, I can combine those two if I wanted to. Like, I actually never really thought about connecting the two. I didn't grow up with like a big sports writer that I kind of looked up to. My writer growing up was Roger Ebert, the old film critic who was from Champaign, Illinois, which is right by where I was from in Mattoon, Illinois. So my hero. So I loved sports, to be very, very clear. I was obsessed with sports. And I loved writing, but it never really occurred to me, kind of dumbly, that you could actually do both of them at the same time. You know, I went to the University of Illinois to be a film critic. And then all of a sudden they were like, hey, can you write about sports? I was like, wait, people do that? Awesome. I love sports. And so I kind of like stumbled into sports writing a little bit.
Well, you could have aspired to be Tellender just as long as it wasn't Mariotti, you know, having colleague of mine.
There is not a universe where I would ever aspire to be anything even resembling Jay Mariotti.
Of course. but I guess that, you know, which leads me to this. And I do want to talk to you about sports and columnists. I had my access taken away by the National Football League and the Baltimore Ravens after 27 years for no apparent reason other than maybe my hair got long or the color of my skin. So, you know, your whole like Deadspin access thing. But I want to talk about the book and you doing this thing where you write books, as you say, every couple of years, which is a lot of my author friends. So that's pretty prolific for being a guy that's got like five other things that you do. When do you find time to do it? And then what inspires you to write a book about, let's see, the new hometown and a pharmacy that's completely made up, but pretty modern from what I'm telling?
Yeah, you know, certainly the idea for the book kind of came out of the idea. The book takes place in June 2021, and I feel like that's actually kind of an important time because, you know, if you remember, that was the time where it felt like we were mostly not if necessarily entirely done with the pandemic. We'd gotten through the hard part, right? Like, we'd been a lot out for, and like, the world was starting to open up a little bit. I remember Tom Hanks's son, Chez Hayes, he called it White Boy Summer, if you remember. That was like the time where people were going to be out doing stuff again. People kind of made fun of it for it, but the vibe was we're going to be able to get out into the world again. But, you know, a lot, we also all went through a lot of trauma, I think, during that period in 2020 and everything went on. So I wanted to kind of write about what it felt like to go through that and to try to get out of it a little bit, because I think that's something we all kind of felt. And I think still, you know, I think the pandemic is officially over, whatever one's thoughts about that. But certainly, I feel like it was a pretty dramatic thing that everyone has all, I think I understand why people would be eager to be done with it. I'm certainly eager to be done with it. But a lot went down that I don't know if we've necessarily all processed. And so the book to me was a way to kind of like try to wrestle with seven different people who all went through very difficult times during that, and then how they end up colliding, intersecting, and hopefully being able to help each other. There is some baseball in the book, I'm proud to report. My last book, How Lucky, was another novel, had no baseball. And people are like, well, we love your novel, but we know you like baseball. You've got to write about some baseball. So I snuck a little bit more baseball in there because I do love writing about baseball.
My last name's Aparicio, and I walk America as a free man because my family came over here and my cousin could slide a little and run the bases and field a little bit. So, I mean, baseball, and I'll definitely get to that. But I want to talk about this prism of seven different people looking at the plague, because it changed my life, right? Like, I went from being Nasty Nestor Sports Sky to having the governor on and talking about the city and wanting to run for mayor of Baltimore and all of these things that happened to me around that period of time, and coming out of it and doing nothing but Zooming, right? Like, I've never been off the air. I've been here talking to people when we were locked down, locked on, the crab cake tour, the things that I'm doing on the back end of this. But I often wonder what would have happened to my life, all of our lives, if it didn't happen. It affected everyone. You take seven people, give me a little slice of where these people come from, because you moved, I think, during this period of time, or find yourself in sort of a new place in lockdown. And I would think these are made from people you've maybe met somewhere down in Athens.
One of the things I like about Athens, and really a lot of college towns in general, it forces a lot of different type of people to come together in a small place. You know, I think that we generally are kind of in our silos, right? I think a lot of people in the world, whether it's politically or demographically, we tend to hang out with people who are like us. And a lot of times in big cities, you can get away with that. Or in like rural areas, you can get away with that. The thing I love about a college town, it is a relatively small geographic place, but there's a lot of different type of people that come there. So like, you've got your college professors in Athens, you have music. REM is from here. The Drive-By Truckers are from here. It's a great music place. So one of the characters runs the rock club in town. That's been closed for the last year, and him trying to get his life back going. He's a recovering alcoholic.
Is that a 40 watt club thing going on?
It is definitely a 40 watt S club. It's not officially the 40 watt, but if you read about the club, it will certainly sound a lot like 40 watt.
I have been to Athens, Will.
Oh yeah, it's the best. 40 watts the best.
I've been between the edges now. Come on.
Oh yeah, 40 watts the best. And so there's a character that's a nurse that was taking care of people during the pandemic. There's a character who is a school teacher. There's an activist, and there's also like an old time like construction guy who's kind of burly, and all these people have to intersect with one another. And I like the idea. One of the things that really struck me about not just the pandemic, but the reaction to the pandemic, very rarely do we have things that everyone experiences. Because again, particularly in a world where we can be online all the time and just select who our audience is and select who the people that are around us are, we often don't interact with people that are different than us. One of the things the pandemic happened is everybody experienced. There's not a human being on the planet that did not go through it, and it did not change them in one way or the other. And so so after we went through all this isolation, then we were all colliding back together again. And I thought it was interesting to kind of write kind of this thriller story about how we all both were alone for a long time, and once we got back together, how we were different and changed. But ultimately, I still think we're good and wanted to help one another.
Will Leach is our guest. Yeah, that Will Leach, the Deadspin guy, the guy you see on TV, the Cardinals fan. The new book is The Time Has Come. We had Will on for How Lucky, God, a couple years ago now.
Years,
we had you on, and I know we talked about falling into this sort of writing style. And is the next one coming, or is there a series coming, or can any of these characters have another life? Because I know all of my fiction buddies like you, sort of think of themselves as writing a James Bond thing. You know what I mean? To some point, there's going to be another, what happened to that little girl in the story, right?
Well, certainly the How Lucky, which was I was very fortunate that with as successful as it was. There's two smaller characters in that book that are larger characters in this book. Both those books take place in Athens. So like there is, I imagine it like a Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul, shared universe sort of thing where they all can interact with one another. You're like, oh, I remember that character from that last book. And yeah, I imagine doing that. I don't think of these things as sequels. They're certainly different stories, but I like the idea. you know, if there's one theme to kind of my fiction writing, it is the notion that the world is both bigger and smaller than we realize. And so, and it's always remarkable to me, particularly as I get older, that I'll run into someone and be like, oh my gosh, I knew this person that you knew 15 years ago, and how small the world feels when that happens. And I think sometimes when we get, because the world does feel so vast and often out of our control, I think it's always good to remind people that actually there are these connections that are constantly be happening throughout us all the time. And so that's a fun thing to write about. So yeah, I'm going to keep writing one of these every 2 years. I'm still doing my sports writing. I think that's a key thing. I did an event in New York last week, and someone asked me, like, what happens if this sells 5 billion copies and you turn into Stephen King or John Grisham? Are you still going to write about baseball? And the answer was yes. I will always write about sports. To me, you know, I love writing and I love sports. It would be a masochistic of myself to stop myself from writing about something that I truly love.
It's fascinating for me, the sports thing, right? Because I was born into it. I was a sports writer at 15 at the paper. And like all of these years, the Orioles free the birds thing, I'll take that honest. Because back in 2006, you were putting Deadspin together, writing about my free the birds walkout.
Yeah,
that happened because the guy had owned the team for 13 years and was a complete civic louse. And no one would say it. Mm. Everyone knew it. He was a pariah everywhere. And they had stunk for 8 years. Just eight. It had only been 8 years then. It felt like 800 when you're 35 for eight baseball seasons. Right. When your last name's Aparicio. So they threw me out 17 years ago. Now the football team that I have been praising, running road trips, having them on 27 Super Bowls. Now the PR director has thrown me out and the owner's okay. It really is amazing how you really hit the nail on the head when Kenny Ballgame came into my condo 18 years ago and said, there's this Deadspin thing, man. Like, you know, access, like, but without access, but like without favor. And I'm like, oh, okay. Well, you know, I'm still on the inside. It really is amazing what sports has become, whether it's, we're going to flex NFL games, even if you have a flight to said city to see the Rams on Sunday. We're going to play the game on Thursday in FU. Like, it's unbelievable how the fans have been gone and how much money has been pushed into this thing and how it's changed it so much. And there are people like you that I'm sure have been mistreated wildly over all of this, that you still love it. I still see you. You absolutely still love it.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons that I don't think Deadspin became really popular because I was just so brilliant and funny, because I don't think that was the case. So I think people wanted a place where they could talk about sports from the outside. And it doesn't mean that you wouldn't get information. Like, one of the fun things about doing Deadspin was, in the early days of Deadspin, someone said, Deadspin, the insider sports side. I was like, we are the literal opposite of that. We would get scoops, right? Because inevitably people within ESPN or within the leagues would be like, complain about their jobs. Like, people like to complain about their jobs all the time and send stuff to us. But the key to that was being on the outside. And I actually think it's really important to kind of almost keep your sanity as a sports fan, particularly as you kind of know how the business has gotten completely out of control. The flex thing is really bad. I wrote a piece for New York Magazine this morning, generally about how, in the wake of how, if you're a sports fan now, ESPN is basically going to make its standalone app where you have to pay for outside of the cable and cord cutting, which means if you let's say you want to watch every Baltimore Orioles game, you have to be able to pay for the local games. You have to pay for Apple TV. You have to pay for Amazon Prime. You have to pay for ESPN.
We found that about Apple on Friday night.
Oh, exactly.
The 55-year-old fart has a team in the pennant race for the first time since like forever. And I will really want to, like, my wife literally, we had food and we're like, we wanted to watch the game and the game wasn't on. And I'm like, who's running this place? Who? And I guess to your point on the Deadspin side, you could say whatever you wanted at any point. The minute that somebody like me says that, they never let you back in again.
Yeah, and I think that, like, having a voice for the person, like, when you're involved deep into baseball or deep in the NFL or wherever you are, you're just thinking about, like, well, my job is not to worry about whether the fans are happy or not. My job is to make money for the corporations and these 32 owners. That's my job. And that's fine. That's more power to you. Everyone's got to make a living. That's fine. But I don't feel like there has been often a voice for the fan to be like, hey, look, seriously, look how expensive it is to have Peacock now and Apple TV and Amazon Prime and MLB TV and all the things you have to have just to be able to watch sports and just to be able to watch your team, I'm willing to pay a certain amount, but it gets a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. And I think that, like, it's fun for me to do that from the outside because that's my perspective. I'm not saying I'm some kind of rebellious outsider that's trying to take down the system. I'm just saying I'm a fan and I like sports and I want to be able to watch sports. Everybody has difficult lives. Everyone goes through a lot. Everybody has a lot of issues. You just want to unwind sometime, just like you're talking about on Friday. You just want to chill out, relax, watch the Orioles, who are super, super fun right now. You want to watch them on a Friday night. And wait, I can subscribe to this thing. And like you get to that point by a lot of people being too close on the inside of sports and only worrying about making money outside of the people who, for the fans, you know, the people who are actually paying for all of this, that line has gotten more of a gap in the last few years. And so I like to try to stay out of it as much as I can. I try to stay as far. I like to write about sports, but I like to write about them from afar rather than too deep within them.
Will Leach is our guest. He has inked the new book. I hope everybody goes out and buys it. You can find him in a million different places, but the book is The Time Has Come. It is fiction, and which is his side hustle, aside from doing sports and writing and more writing and more writing. Man, I have so many notes here, but you've said some rather prescient things over the years, but certainly in the framework of the conversation about that is your perspective, right? Like, your perspective is the road you've walked, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the difference now are the team websites and the league restricting access to anything that feels like journalism while pushing forth some sort of Putin-esque, I don't even know what it is, where they have fake columnists because they all work at the pleasure of the owner and work at the pleasure of the coach. I go into these press conferences now, half the people in there are employed by the coach they're asking questions of.
Certainly, I think, and that's a trend that's happening outside of just sports too. But certainly sports is happening. A lot of it's, frankly, you know, I mean, listen, you've been in this business long enough. You remember when there were 5 newspapers covering these teams, or 6 or 7 newspapers covering these teams. Now those newspapers aren't there. Now you've got The Athletic, and you've got like a lot of, particularly in college sports, you've got a lot of individual websites covering the sports. But yeah, I mean, the business has a lot of the sports journalism business, not just, I guess, all of journalism has changed and shrunk and kind of contracted in a way. But the fact is, people still want the information. And so what's happened is a lot of leagues and a lot of teams have basically taken more power over that information. It is remarkable to me, the example I always use in this, 3 years ago, I followed the St. Louis Cardinals and followed them pretty closely. 3 years ago, they fired Mike Schilt, their manager. We still don't know why. Like, we still don't know why. There's the official statement was, we support what Mike Schilt has done and wish him good luck in his future endeavors. And the reporters did the best they could to maybe get a few theories. But there was a time 20 years ago, there'd have been 8 reporters killing each other.
Oh, my boy, Bernie Miklas would have been all over that.
Of course.
Would have been on at the late, exactly, great moment of silence for Rick Hummel.
Of course.
Would have been, I mean, because those, and if they didn't have it, Joe Buck would have had it, or Costas would have had it, or whatever, because they're St. Louis people and they're there.
Yeah. And I just think that, like, that kind of, there was an understanding too that the team owed the reporters and therefore the public.
They owed the fans an explanation.
That was the understanding. Now I don't think teams have that. I think teams believe that they can. We don't owe them anything. We will keep it in house. We do. The reporters are jackals trying to get to mess with us. I think there's a siege mentality, particularly. I think part of it is, frankly, the weakening of the journalism. But frankly, part of it is just a massive amount of money that's come into sports now. There is more of a corporate mentality as opposed to we're running a sports team mentality. I always think of Ted Turner. Ted Turner, when he bought the Braves, he's like, yeah, I'm a billionaire. How awesome will it be to own a sports team? I don't care if I make money off this team. I want to win the World Series. This is amazing. Owners don't have that idea now. A lot of these, as you know well in Baltimore, a lot of these are family-owned organizations and family operation where this is their primary income. And there's a lot of kids who just the team, they need to make money off this team. Otherwise, they'll have to go get another job. They'll have to get a real job. So as opposed to, there was a time in sports history where owning a sports team was considered like a trophy. And whether you just hope to break even and then get a parade when your team wins the World Series or the Super Bowl. Now these teams make so much money, they are seen almost wholly as business and corporations. And I think that's just something that pushes more and more on the fans and keeps more information in rather than feeling an obligation for the fans, who, again, I remind, are paying for all of this to actually know what's going on.
See, dude, this is where I'm going to promote my own book, because I'm re-releasing the Peter Principles online this month. The nature of Bill DeWitt buying the Baltimore Orioles out of bankruptcy from Eli Jacobs 32 years ago, and the difference between that and Peter Angelos, and the difference between Dan Snyder and whatever else would have happened here. I mean, it really does take, when you say it's the mindset of the owner, it's the mindset of the business. The Ravens came here as purple Barneys trying to make their way and sell poor suckers licenses, PSLs to people. And it was this neighborhood. We took the Colts from you. Screw the NFL. Tagliabue told us to build a museum. All of that went down. And to feel this corporate thing where they're taking $600 million of civic money to fix their stadiums, right, but then not front-facing, that's something in my town, specifically in this town. And I would think, I know you're a Cardinals fan, where they've lost two football teams, where part of the Cardinals' charm is that it still feels like Stan Musial's team, and it feels like Lou Brock's team. And if you were a kid, it might feel like Vince Coleman or what, you know, whatever your thing is, it felt homespun. The Orioles are so FUBAR. I mean, the boys fighting with each other over the billion dollars. I mean, just it's heinous. And then the football side of it is, the football owners just sort of walked away for the last 20 years, living on a boat, cashing checks. The thing's worth $5 billion now. He's got a parade. He never changed. Guys have jobs for life. So it's a really different, and there's nobody going to the games. And the Ravens, like, advertise at length for you to buy tickets, individual game tickets, when they were sold out for a generational, you know, in my era. We're in a different place, but this town specifically, and town to town, and it is, especially baseball being so not regional, but like really just local or hyperlocal, unless you're St. Louis or Atlanta and you have like five states, the Orioles are way, way small and trying to make this thing bigger. Yet their tactics with fans, media, all of that is the mindset that you talk about, which is, you find the game, you find it. Spring training, we don't put those on TV, on the network we own. I mean, there's just been so many trusts broken, Will. I guess that's my thing. In Baltimore specifically.
Yeah, and listen, I think it's definitely true in Baltimore. And I think you see it really, you do see it in a lot of places. I think a lot of it is because these teams make money and they don't really have to work very hard to because there's so many television contracts and there's so many things kind of built up. It's really, really hard for a sports team to lose money. And even if they do lose like a little money year after year, some teams lost money, for example, in 2020 because of the pandemic, but like they're totally back on revenue. And B, even if they broke even for a year, trust me, you sell that team. No one's selling a team for not four or five times what they paid for. They've all got this golden parachute at the end, no matter what sort of happens. And so because of that, when that happens, they're a corporation that doesn't actually have to act like other corporations. Like most corporations have to like have good governance and have to like answer to shareholders or have to answer to the bottom line. Sports teams generally don't have to do that anymore. And so you find yourself in this weird kind of sad spot where if you are a fan, and I'm a St. Louis Cardinals fan, not because one day I sat down with all 32 teams and said, who's going to be my team? I grew up with the Cardinals. That's who I am. Like your name's Aparicio. Like you're going to be involved with the Orioles no matter what. People pick their teams. One of my best friends here in town is a diehard Orioles fan because grew up in Maryland, and of course it's going to be his team.
He has suffered, Will.
And he couldn't get rid of the Orioles if he wanted to. Like, he could not just say, never mind, I'm not watching anymore, because particularly now, they're good. He feels like he's earned it. But the problem is so many of all these people that cheer for these teams, it's just, you just cross your fingers that your billionaire is better than the other billionaires. And that's a really weird place to think about as a sports fan. You're almost at the whim of just some random wealthy person. The Phoenix Suns are going through this, right? Like, they had a terrible billionaire before. Now we're going to find out what kind of billionaire they have now as an owner. It's a very weird spot when all you want to do is just watch your team and cheer for them.
I'm Googling Stockholm syndrome right now. Yes. Will Leach is here. He writes great, great things. A writer of great writings. Go follow him. The new book is out. You can go check it out. The time has come. And if fiction's not your thing, you can always stick with Team Will and Illinois and St. Louis. And by the way, I want to end with this because you and I were in the same building and chasing Springsteen around a little bit back on some winter days a couple months ago. There is something about music that I think we share that is, for me, has been through all the sports and 45 years of covering it and caring about it and being immersed in it. That's still my outlet that, you know, when I see you taking folks to see Bruce, I'm like, you know, life is good when Bruce is on tour. You know?
Oh, it was great. You know, and like, you know, my parents, like I was introduced to Bruce Springsteen when I was 8 years old and my parents were obsessed with Born in the USA. And so like, and then I got obsessed with it. To me, I like that guy. I got this one, and then I went back and listened to Nashville, and you know, and listened to Atlantic, and listen to that album. And then you go back forward and you listen to you get obsessed with like the later albums. And I love the folk album that he does. And to me, it's a life history. Like the thing about Springsteen, he's been making music for so long that it really becomes kind of the soundtrack to a lot of people's lives. Like you've been listening to this stuff for so long. To me, it's a really kind of wonderful thing to share that with like a family, right? To share that with my parents who have their own experience. And I'm like, no, Nebraska's a really great one. Nebraska's a really great one. And then and I'm like, no, Devils and Dust is a great one. And it becomes like a way that you share with your family, both memories and new experiences. And also, I mean, for crying out loud, the guy is a boundless source of energy. To like see him going out there at that age with the energy that I don't know, most of the kid rock bands I see, it's just a 23-year-old kid strumming, like, going into a microphone like this. Springsteen's bouncing around the stage and losing his mind in his 70s. It's a pretty awesome thing to see.
I'm a Tunnel of Love guy. And,
I get that.
And people thought that was fiction, but it turns out it might have been a little bit more than that.
I think he was going through some stuff at the time.
Yeah, he was going through some ish, as I remember it. You know, he tells a story, because I've seen him in St. Louis several times. He tells a story of falling in love with Patty under the arch on that tour, on the Born in the USA tour, toward Tunnel of Love. Hey, dude, appreciate you. Keep writing what you're writing. Keep being the American writer that you are.
American writer, says Wikipedia, of course. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Love my visits with you. Will Leach, we'll be following you, the family, the kids, but you're not winning the World Series this year. This is coming home to Baltimore.
I love those. I got Orioles fever, man. That team is so fun right now.
I'm going to call you about August, maybe into September. We'll see where things are settled right around then. And listen, man, all these years, it's nice to talk about baseball again.
It is. You know, it's gotta it really be. Is. It's got to be. Yeah, fans, Baltimore fans have absolutely earned it.
All right. And I will not be writing the book on the Orioles championship that no one will want to buy. I did that on the Ravens 10 years ago. Will Leach can be found out on the interwebs. Make sure you find his book, The Time Has Come. You can find us. The Time Has Come for the Maryland Crab Cake Tour, back out on the road to Falston, the local this week. We're going to be at Spirits West. We're going to be at Shannon's. Lots of places. Costas, Pappas, all over the place. All brought to you by the Maryland Lottery, giving these away. 50th anniversary scratch-offs. Had a lot of winners. And our friends at Window Nation, 866-90-NATION. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570. Towson, Baltimore. We never stop talking. Baltimore, positive.